the two masters, and wasn't suing on their own. The result was mixed. Some states said there was protection, while others said there was no performance right in the sound recordings. Most of the cases were settled, though some are ongoing. Anyway, all this shook up the streaming services enough to support a section of the Music Modernization Act, refer back to Chapter 16, called the Classics Protection and Access Act. The Classics Protection section says it's not creating a copyright for the pre-1972 masters, but instead gives the owner of a pre-72 master the same rights to collect money that owners of post-72 masters have. In essence, for interactive services, this means the labels now license pre-1972 masters to the DSPs on the same terms as post-72 masters. For non-interactive uses, the Classics Act says the pre-1972 masters are subject to the same compulsory licenses as the new stuff, meaning they get paid by Sound Exchange at the same rate as post-72 masters. Interestingly, unlike federal copyrights, state law copyrights have no expiration. So in theory, the old stuff could have been subject to payment longer than the new recordings, like forever. Under the MMA, however, there is now a limit on how long you can get paid for pre-1972 recordings. Specifically, it's 95 years from first publication, meaning release to the public. But there are some extensions of this 95 years for older masters. If a master was first published before 1923, you get until December 31st, 2021. If it was first published between 1923 and 1946, you get 5 years beyond the 95 years. If it was first published between 1947 and 1956, you get an extra 15 years on top of the 95. The party's over for all pre-1972 masters on February 15, 2067, 95 years after the effective date of the 1972 Sound Recording Act. How to terminate a copyright transfer in your spare time for fun and profit. As noted in Chapter 19, the 1976 Copyright Act lets you undo any deal for songs created on or after January 1, 1978, 35 years later. We'll talk about the pre-1978 songs later in this chapter. So if you sell your song to a publisher and have a lifetime of regret, you can get it back after 35 years by merely sending a notice. Remember, this is only for the United States. You're still stuck for the rest of the world. Here's how to do it. You can give a notice of termination no less than 2 years nor more than 10 years before its effective date. And that effective date has to be within 5 years after the end of the 35-year period. To be more precise, if the grant of the work covers publication, which it almost always does, the right to terminate is effective on the sooner of 40 years from the grant or 35 years from publication. This protects you even if the work is never published. This is easier to understand if we use some actual years. For example, if a copyright was transferred and published in 2000, the years in which termination can be effective, from 35 to 40 years after publication, are 2035 to 2040. The first year that notice can be sent, 10 years before first possible effective date, 2025. Last year that the notice can be sent, 2 years before the last possible effective date, is 2038. If you really want to know the details, take a look at sections 203 and 304 of the Copyright Act, which you can find online. The Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which we discussed in Chapter 19, added some frills to this. They are, 1. Previously, only a living author, surviving spouse, or surviving children or grandchildren could exercise the right of termination. If none of them are alive, the author's estate can do the honors. 2. There's a second bite at termination rights for pre-1978 copyrights, which I'll go over in a minute. Remember, as we discussed previously, this termination only applies to U.S. rights. If you sold off your copyright in foreign territories, quel dommage! Attempts to avoid termination. As much as the publishers would love to avoid termination, Uncle Sam says no. The copyright law says that nothing you do with the termination rights is valid until you actually have the rights back. In other words, you can't sign them over to anyone until you actually have them in your fist. The only exception is that you can make a deal with the guy whose rights are about to be terminated after you've sent the notice. In other words, if you send a notice to the publisher saying the termination is effective 3 years from now, you can make a new deal with that publisher during the 3 years before the rights come back, and that's enforceable. This gives the current publisher a head start because they can make a deal and pay you for the rights before anyone else can. Extension rights. Extension recapture. So Congress took care of folks who wrote songs after 1978 by giving them the rights to get out of a stupid deal after 35 years. But what about the oldsters who made stupid deals? There's a transitional quirk thrown into the 1976 Copyright Act that takes care of the pre-1978 copyrights. If you weren't writing prior to 1978, or aren't the heir of such a writer, you can skip to the next section on terminating sound recording copyrights. This isn't mandatory. Feel free to listen to this for your general education, but I don't suggest driving or operating heavy machinery afterward. As we touched on earlier, pre-1978 copyrights lasted for a period of 56 years, the 28 plus 28 we discussed back in Chapter 19. The 1976 Act extended that to a period of 75 years, meaning it added 19 years to the 56 years that already existed. And as we discussed, this has now been extended to 95 years. In 1976, in addition to extending the life of the copyrights to 75 years, your congresspeople gave the author, or his or her heirs, the right to take back the new 19 years. The recapture procedure is similar to that for termination rights of post-1978 copyrights, the right to terminate after 35 years, which we discussed in the prior section. It's done by giving a notice no sooner than 2 years and no more than 10 years before the beginning of the 19 years, i.e., no more than 2 years or later than 10 years before the end of the 56th year. For example, if a song was first published in 1972, the 56 years expire in 2028. So beginning in 2018, 10 years before the end of the 56 years, and ending 2026, 2 years before, you can give a notice to be effective in 2026. After the effective date of the notice, the 19 years added to the copyright, the extension from 2026 to 2045, belong to the author or his or her heirs. As with the termination rights, this is only for the United States. The rest of the world has still gone bye-bye. Just like the 35-year termination, Congress gave the original publishers a nice perk. The law says that before the extended term actually comes into effect, but after giving a termination notice, the person who got the original grant can make a new deal for the added 19 years. So the original publisher has the ability to buy the rights at least 2 years before any outsider, and therefore has an advantage in getting them. Unless the publisher has really been a jerk during the first 56 years, which is no small unless, it can usually keep the copyrights. Now enter the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998, which added 20 years to the copyright term and made the extension period 39 years after the original 56 years. In other words, a total of 95 years. They also threw in, at no extra charge, an added bonus. If your right to recapture came up before October 27, 1998, and you forgot to send the termination notice, you get another bite. At any time within 5 years after expiration of the first 75 years, the old 56 plus the 19 you blew, you can get back the newly added 20 years. What exactly did I just get back? So you've sent your notices, waited until the magic date to get your rights back, and are ready to rumble. What exactly did you just get handed? Can you now do anything you want with those rights? Well, it's not exactly that simple. A provision of the termination/extension law rights says that the original publisher can no longer license any new works, but they can continue exploiting derivative works created while they own the song. Refer back to Chapter 15 for a definition of derivative works. And for a while, this derivative work exception looked like it was going to be a loophole you could drive a truck through. The opening act was a U.S. Supreme Court case involving the appropriately titled song, Who's Sorry Now? If you want to look it up, it's Mills Music v. Snyder, Volume 105, Supreme Court Reporter, page 638, 1985. In this case, the publisher, Mills Music, acquired the rights to Who's Sorry Now? From Ted Snyder and two other writers. Snyder went to that great songbook in the sky, and in 1978, his heirs exercised their right to terminate the last 19 years. So much for the idea that the initial publisher can hang on to the songs. After termination, Mills Music argued that all of the records it had licensed were derivative works, and therefore it had the right to collect mechanical royalties for sales of these records after termination. As you can imagine, Mr. Snyder's heirs took a contrary view. They felt these rights should come back to them, so they could then license the record companies and get all the money. The decision flipped back and forth until it came to the U.S. Supreme Court, known to its friends as the Supremes. In a closely divided decision, 5 of the 9 justices in favor, 4 opposing, the Supreme Court found that indeed the records were derivative works, and that the money from them went to Mills Music, the terminated publisher. Mr. Snyder's heirs had the right to money from future recordings, but not the existing ones. Sorry, all you little Snyders. After Mills Music, 2 other cases dealt with the scope of a publisher's right to hang on to derivative works. The first was Woods v. Born Company, Volume 603, Federal Reporter, 2nd Series, page 978, 2nd Circuit, 1995, where the terminated publisher argued that every piece of printed music was based on the original lead sheet, and therefore the right to put out sheet music forever belonged to the old publisher. Refer back to Chapter 18 for what a lead sheet is. The court kicked the publisher's butt on that one, holding that new versions of printed music weren't derivative works and therefore belonged to the new publisher. Next came Fred Allert Music Corp. v. Warner Chapel Music, Inc., Volume 155, Federal Reporter, 3rd Series, page 17, 2nd Circuit, 1998, where the court made the derivative work exception even narrower by saying that the reissue of a master recording with a different catalog number was not a derivative work, even though it was the same recording. Accordingly, the new publisher of the song could issue the mechanical license and get the dough. So, as you can see, the sentiment in the later cases is to expand the rights of the person getting back their copyrights. Stay tuned to this channel. As the older copyrights tick on and terminations become more prevalent, there may be some more interesting law. Sound recording copyright terminations. The right to terminate transfers of sound recordings, which started coming up in 2013, 35 years after the 1978 Act, is a fascinating area. What's happening is that artists are sending termination notices to record companies, and the companies are fighting back. Since the earliest days, record contracts have all had language that says the sound recordings are works for hire. And remember, there's no termination right for works for hire. Refer back to Chapter 19 if you want a refresher on works for hire. To be a work for hire, however, you need more than just language. As we discussed previously, the work has to fall into one of several specific categories. Refer back to Chapter 19. One of the work for hire categories is a collective work, and the record companies argue that masters are contributions to a collective work, an album, and are therefore works for hire. They also throw in any other arguments they may have in each specific situation. For example, the form or timing of the notice might have been defective. In virtually every instance of which I'm aware, the companies and artists have come to an agreement to settle the claims. The companies offer better terms under the deal, higher royalty, advances, etc., and the artist generally goes along. In part, this is because a fight would be incredibly expensive, and it's also because the stakes for the record labels are very high. If they get a court decision that says masters aren't works for hire, it could cost them all their old masters, so they will fight to the death. On the artist's side, however, they're only fighting about a few masters that many times don't earn enough in the United States to justify the expense of litigation. Remember, terminations are only for the U.S. Also looming in the background is the idea that neither side necessarily wants a court result. If it favors the company, the artist is stuck with an old deal, and if it favors the artist, the companies lose massively on their catalog. So they compromise. There was recently a class action filed on behalf of artists over this very issue. A class action means that it covers everyone who's similarly situated, so it's more economical to have an expensive fight. This could bring the issue to a head, but at the time of this writing, it's way too soon to tell. The copyright notice. The copyright notice, other than for sound recordings, is a C with a circle around it, followed by the year of copyright, the year that the work was first fixed in tangible form. The symbol for sound recordings is a P with a circle around it. Look for these on your CDs, assuming you still have any. Copyright notices are much less significant under the 1976 Copyright Act than they were under the old law, because the consequences of leaving it off or making a mistake in it are no longer very serious. Under the old law, you could lose your copyright. It's not worth getting into all the niceties, but nowadays a notice basically just protects you from someone saying they had no idea the materials were copyrighted. In other words, they can't say they were an innocent infringer. You don't get a free pass if you're an innocent infringer, but it could affect how much you have to pay if you get nailed. For songs, the copyright notice is primarily significant for printed music. That's because you need only put a notice on visibly perceptible copies of something. Since you can't see a song by looking at a digital file or CD, there's no need to have a copyright notice for the song. So why do you see copyright notices on CDs? Good question. The reasons are: A. Sometimes the lyrics are printed inside, and since they are visually perceptible, you need a copyright notice. B. There is a copyright in the album cover artwork, and C. There is the sound recording copyright notice. Registration and deposit. The myth. It's a myth that you get a copyright by registering your work with the Copyright Office. As we discussed, you get a copyright by fixing the work in tangible form. However, registering a copyright with the Copyright Office gives you certain legal remedies you don't otherwise have, so you should always do it if you're going to commercially exploit your work. But the failure to register doesn't affect the validity of your copyright. So if you're a beginning songwriter, it's probably not worth the money until someone bites. The old trick of mailing a copy of the work to yourself actually accomplishes something. It's sometimes called a poor man's copyright, but that's not true. Remember, you already have the copyright by putting it in tangible form. The only thing you get from mailing it to yourself is a clearly established date on which you created your work. So if someone rips it off at a later date, you can prove your work was created before theirs. If you're going to do this, send it by certified mail, and don't get excited and open it when it arrives. Store it in a safe place, and let a judge open it if someone ever gets cute. Having a date-stamped digital file accomplishes the same thing, though I'm told, anecdotally, not reliably, that digital dates may be manipulated. If that's true, then this evidence isn't as strong as a letter. If you've posted your song to a website, that's pretty reliable info. But you have to be sure the site keeps track of the date, and of course, that the site is still in business when you have an issue. Why register? Let me count the ways. If your work is going to be commercially exploited, released on records, used in a film, a commercial, etc., you should register with the Copyright Office. If you don't, you lose the following goodies. 1. You can't collect compulsory license royalties. Refer back to Chapter 15. 2. As we discussed earlier, you can't file an infringement action unless you first registered the copyright. That means you can't recover damages or stop someone from using your song until you've registered. You're allowed to wait and register just before you file the lawsuit, but it's a better idea to take care of it as soon as you know there's going to be a recording, because of numbers 3, 4, and 5 to come. 3. A recent Supreme Court case held that you must have a registration in your hand before you can file your lawsuit. For Supreme Court stalkers, the case is Fourth Estate Public Benefit Corporation versus WallStreet.com, Volume 138, Supreme Court Recorder, page 720, 2018. Before that case, some of the lower courts said it was enough for you to have filed the registration, but now it actually has to be issued, meaning the Copyright Office has officially accepted it in their records, before you can sue. And waiting for the government to grind your registration through its gears can mean a delay of up to 9 months after filing, which means a delay before you can file your lawsuit. So today, it's an even better idea to get going early if you've got a record coming out. 4. If you don't register within 5 years after first publication of the work, you lose the legal presumption that everything in the registration is valid. This mumbo-jumbo basically means that if you do register within the 5 years, a court will assume that everything in your registration is correct, and the infringer has the burden of proving it's not. If you don't, you have to prove it's correct. 5. You can't recover attorney's fees, nor can you get statutory damages. Refer back to Chapter 19. Unless you registered before the infringement happened. You can get the forms you need to register, and in fact, register electronically, at www.copyright.gov, unless that's now become an Amazon subsidiary. Deposit. A separate requirement from registration is the obligation to deposit copies of the best edition of your work within 3 months after publication. If you don't, there's no loss of copyright, but there are penalties and fines. The purpose of this is to keep the Library of Congress overflowing with tons of crap that nobody has ever heard of, and the system works quite well. You can deposit CDs or sheet music for songs, or if your work is unpublished or published only in electronic form, you can deposit electronically. Moral rights. In a number of countries outside the United States, there's a legal concept known as moral rights, or by the snooty term droit moral, which in French means moral rights, and in Czech means no parking. The concept, among others, is that an author can stop any mutilation of his or her work, even though they may have parted with it long ago. For example, the creator of a painting, even though it's been sold 4 or 5 times, could stop someone from cutting it into smaller paintings, drawing mustaches on it, etc. Similarly, the author of a musical work can stop substantial changes in the music or lyrics. And you also get the right to stop someone from falsely attributing your work to someone else. The United States has never recognized a moral rights concept for music, even though it is required to do it under something called the Berne Convention, which is a multi-nation treaty designed to protect creative works. The best we've done is a limited moral right for paintings and fine art. Accordingly, to the extent you want any protection, you gotta put it in your songwriter/publisher contract, as we discussed back in Chapter 18. And in virtually every contract, you'll be asked to waive, meaning give up, your moral rights, which you'll have to do. If you're in a group, keep straight ahead. If not in a group, go to Chapter 22, What's in a Name? If you're bored, take a nice walk around the block. Part 4. Group Issues. Chapter 21. Groups. If you're a member of a group, everything in this book applies to you. But you also get a whole set of treats that don't concern individual artists. Let's take a look at them. Group provisions in record deals. There's a whole section in group record deals that isn't in a solo artist's contract. It spells out what happens if the group breaks up, or if one individual, a prima donna, or the only rational member, depending on your side of the fence, decides he or she no longer wants to play with the others. Key members. Most agreements will say that a breach of the record deal by one member of the group is treated as a breach by all members of the group. In other words, if one member refuses to record with the others, the whole group is in breach. This is not such an unreasonable position if we're talking about the lead singer or main songwriter or key instrumentalist. But it's not so hot if you're talking about a percussionist who neither sings, writes, nor knows what state he lives in. To handle our percussionist friend, we who represent artists gave birth to the concept of a key member. Under this system, a few folks in the group are listed in the contract as key members, and if a key member leaves the group or otherwise breaches the agreement, the record company can treat that as a breach by the whole group and exercise its various options, which we'll discuss in a minute. If anyone else screws up, it can't. This is something you have to ask for. No company uses a key member concept in its form agreements. Also, as you might imagine, working this out has been known to rankle bands. The people who aren't named as key members can get their noses out of joint. It also puts the lawyer/manager in the position of dealing with who's key and who isn't, which can sometimes make non-key members feel like their representatives are playing favorites. However, as you'll see, it isn't always so great to be a key member. The company's rights to leaving members. What can a company do if a member, key or not, leaves the group? 1. All companies provide that, if a member leaves a group, the company has the option to get his or her services as a solo artist and as a member of any other group. This is reasonable enough. Without it, you could get out of your record deal just by leaving the band. Even when you have a key member concept, however, the company will want the right to pick up all leaving members, key and non-key alike. I like to argue that the company has no business, or usually interest in, keeping the services of non-key members, such as our percussionist. This is also how you sell the percussionist on not being a key member. If he decides to leave the group, he can split from the record company and make his own deal, which a key member can't. But if the company insists on the right to pick him up as a soloist, even if he's not a key member, it scraps this argument. 2. The company gets the option to keep the members who don't leave the group, assuming, of course, there's not a total breakup. 3. The company has the option to terminate the members who didn't leave, since the group is no longer the one they signed. Note, this means if they don't exercise their option for the leaving member, that the deal is over. So make sure that only a key member's leaving can trigger this right. 4. There's a relatively new concept that some companies are using regarding band reunions. It says that if 75% or more of the band gets back together within 5 years after the deal was terminated for any one or more of the members, the company gets to reinstate the deal for the band. This is to keep you from breaking up to get out of the deal, then having a miraculous primal therapy session that gets you back together the next week. From your point of view, keep the period as short as possible. By the way, if they've picked anyone up as a soloist before your reunion, those deals stay in effect, even if they reinstate the overall band deal. Leaving member deals. The person leaving the group is cleverly called a leaving member. The terms of a leaving member's solo agreement are spelled out in the group's deal and are almost always less favorable than the deal for the group. The record company's position, which is understandable, is that the soloist is an unknown quantity, whereas the group was the reason for making the deal. Success is by no means assured. There are many cases of soloists who have left groups to fall flat on their faces, as well as those who have been more successful than the groups they came from. If the group is important enough, the soloist's royalty may be close to or the same as the group's. But the advance is almost always substantially less, and the commitment is usually for one album at most, sometimes only demos. As your bargaining power increases, so does your ability to negotiate these clauses, particularly if a member of a group has been emerging as the star or had an earlier solo career. As a practical matter, no matter how funky the leaving member provisions are, the company is often willing to negotiate better terms when the breakup happens. Trivia quiz. Name the lead singers who have had solo careers after leaving the following groups. 1. The Police. 2. White Stripes. 3. Destiny's Child. Name the groups from which the following soloists came. 1. Justin Timberlake. 2. Neil Young, not Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. 3. Eminem. Answers at the end of this chapter. Deficits. What happens to the group's deficit, unrecouped balance, when a soloist sets out on his or her own? Suppose a group breaks up and is $500,000 unrecouped. The company then picks up one member as a soloist who streams in the billions. Can the company take his or her solo royalties to recoup the group's $500,000 deficit? Conversely, if the group was recouped but the soloist is a flop, can the company use the group's royalties to recoup the soloist's deficit? Many companies, at least in their first draft contract, take the right to do both these things. If you ask, however, they will sometimes agree that only a pro rata share of the group's deficit can be charged to the soloist, though this is harder for key members. For example, if there are 5 members of the group, only 1/5 of the deficit, $100,000 of the $500,000 in the given example, can be carried over to a solo deal. Conversely, if you ask, they'll also agree only to charge the soloist's pro rata share of group royalties with the soloist's deficit. Companies will sometimes agree not to charge the soloist's share of group royalties with a deficit under the solo agreement, but this takes more bargaining power. You should provide that, if the group continues to record without the soloist, no future group deficits can be charged to the soloist's account or to the soloist's share of group royalties. It's not uncommon for a successful group, after a key member leaves, to record several dud records, which then eat up all the old, successful record royalties. If these flops also eat up the ex-member's royalties on the successful records, he or she will be, shall we say, perturbed. For example, suppose Harvey leaves the group after making 4 successful albums. Because the group did well, it's fully recouped, and Harvey retires to that dream house in Elk's End expecting to live on his future royalties from these four albums. The group, without Harvey, then goes into the studio and runs up $1 million trying to make the next Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which streams 300 times. If you don't change the form, the company will take Harvey's royalties from the four successful albums and use them to get back the $1 million it spent on the flop. Harvey will not be pleased. Most companies will agree not to charge future costs against a person who has left, because the leaving member doesn't participate in the future record's royalties and thus shouldn't bear the costs. But you gotta ask. Internal group deals. Why you need an internal contract. Suppose there are two plumbers in Bug Tussle, Kentucky. There really is such a place. Google it if you don't believe me. And I'm pretty sure they have at least one plumber. If these plumbers decide to go into business together, they know enough to have a lawyer write them a partnership agreement, or at least go to LegalZoom.com and get a form. On the other hand, groups earning tens of millions of dollars sometimes never get around to formalizing their relationship, and every once in a while, this neglect bites them in the butt. The time to make an agreement among yourselves is now, when everybody is all friendly and kissy face. When you're fighting with each other, particularly if there's a lot of money on the table, you may find yourself killing the goose that lays the golden eggs, as well as supporting the retirement fund for entertainment lawyers. One of my early experiences as a music lawyer was trying to solve the problems of a major group who'd never formalized their relationship. One of the two founding members got pumped up by a relative who told him he was the real star of the group, even though he didn't sing or write. So he tried to stop the other guy from using the group name. Because they were set up as a corporation, with equal votes, they got so deadlocked that they couldn't agree to pay the phone bill. We had to go to court and ask the judge to appoint a neutral third director to break the tie. The court chose a crusty ex-judge who wore a three-piece suit with a watch chain. He'd done this for many bitterly fighting corporations and was supposed to be the tiebreaker that finally let the corporation move forward. Well, his honor lasted about 3 months, saying, "I've never in my days seen anything as nasty as this," before disappearing into the sunset and leaving behind a large bill. The upshot was that the litigation lasted more than 9 years, and it cost the parties more than $1 million in legal fees. The group was killed early in the process, and the fellow who started the fight ended up broke, all of which could have been avoided with a simple agreement and a few hours of planning. So pay attention and take care of it now. I know, nobody likes to talk about negative stuff, like breakups, when everything is working well. But believe me, when everything is going well is exactly the time to discuss it, because you can do it in a friendly way. It's like insurance. You may never need it, but you'll sure be glad you have it if you do. So find a third party, like a lawyer, to blame for raising the issue, so you don't have to take the heat. I routinely say that I'm the jerk insisting on this, so you can be a good guy. Or have everyone listen to this audiobook with this paragraph queued up. But enough fatherly advice. Here's what you should do. I'm referring to folks as partners in this discussion, though there may be a different legal structure, as we'll see later. The most important asset. Can you guess what your most important asset is? Apart from your good looks, charm, and talent, your most important asset is the group name. So whatever else you do, by all means, figure out what to do with your group name if there's a fight. In fact, if you only deal with your name in a written agreement, I will be happy, but not ecstatic. To get me there, you have to deal with everything. You have to think through everything about the group name, such as what happens if, 1, the lead singer and songwriter leave the group, 2, the drummer who doesn't write music or sing leaves the group, 3 out of 5 members leave to form another group, 4, the group breaks up and everybody goes back to Waxahachie. Obviously, there are about 10,000 other possibilities, But all of them can be covered with a few general rules. You can, of course, do anything you want, but the most common solutions run along these lines. 1. No one can use the name if the group breaks up, regardless of how many of you are still performing together. Short of all of you, of course. 2. A majority of the group members performing together can use the name. For example, if there are 5 people in a group that breaks up, any 3 of them together can use the name. 3. Only the lead singer, Sylvia, can use the name, regardless of who she's performing with. 4. Only George, the songwriter who founded the group and thought of the name, can use it, regardless of who he's performing with. 5. George and Sylvia can use the name as long as they perform together, but if they don't, no one can use it. If one or two people really created the unique sound of the group, I've always thought they should have the right to use the name. That's because the others alone wouldn't truly represent the group to the public. On the other hand, many groups operate on a majority rule principle, regardless of that spirit. And I'm sure we can both name successful touring groups who've replaced the lead singer over time. So anything you can imagine is okay, as long as everyone agrees and it has some rational basis that a judge can understand. Just do something. What happens if you don't do anything? As you can gather from my previous horror story, the law is not very helpful. In fact, there is very little law on the subject, surprising as that sounds. That's because most disputes are settled privately, even though they may start as lawsuits. The cases that have gone the distance turn on the question of whether the performing members are deceiving the public. The argument is that one or more key people are the essence of the group, and anyone using the name without them defrauds the public. And that gets decided by a judge whose favorite singer is probably Wayne Newton. If you think this sounds messy and expensive to resolve, you're right. So, solve it yourself. Now. Percentages. The next important thing to decide is everybody's percentages. It may surprise you to learn that there are many bands who, despite laughing, giggling, and slapping high fives on stage, are in fact owned or controlled by one or two people, and everybody else is merely a hired hand. Being a hired hand doesn't necessarily mean you're on a salary. You can be a hired hand and get both a salary and a percentage of the profits. It does, however, mean you serve at the will and pleasure of the employer, which actually makes for a rather pleasant band atmosphere. Somehow, the knowledge that you could be out on the street tomorrow keeps people's attitudes a lot healthier than if they think they have a lifetime gig. Hiring people usually isn't practical for new artists, because you don't have the money to pay them much of a salary, if you have any money at all. So most of the time with new bands, everyone works for a percentage of the future pie. Assuming you're all going to be partners, how should the profits be shared? Again, there are no rules. You can do it any way that makes you happy. The simplest way, of course, is to split things equally. If there are 5 of you, everyone gets 1/5, or 20%. This is common in new bands, but it can become a source of irritation if some members work harder or contribute more than others, such as handling all the media interviews. Another approach I've seen, with a band that was built on a core of 2 people who were together for a number of years before the others joined, gave the 2 founders a bigger percentage than the others. And frankly, even when everyone has been together from the beginning, there may be 1 or 2 key members who deserve more than the others. By the way, nothing says you have to use the same percentage for all areas. Sometimes bands split evenly on concert monies on the theory that everyone is out there sweating together, but have different splits for records, merchandising, television performances, etc. Control. Just as ownership doesn't need to be equal, neither does control of the band's decisions. Normally, you vote in proportion to your percentage of profits, but this isn't carved in stone. So even if your percentages are equal, 1 or 2 key members may control the vote. For example, they may have 2 votes where everybody else has 1. Or it can be set up so that the group can't act without one of the key members agreeing, regardless of how many people want to do it. The possibilities are endless, but they need to be thought out carefully. For example, try not to have an even number of votes, because this allows a deadlock, meaning an equally divided vote where nothing can be done. If you have an even number of votes, you could have a third party like your manager break the tie, but it's way better to do it inside the group. Songwriting/publishing. Another common issue is how to handle publishing. Does everyone own the songs, or shares of songs, that they create? Meaning that every time you write a song, you agree on the percentage everyone contributed, and each writer owns that percentage of the song? Or are all the songs split evenly, maybe owned by a group entity, regardless of who wrote them? I've certainly seen both, but the majority tend to have the creators own their share of the songs individually. Over time, with big success, it can also become a source of resentment if someone is getting substantial money from songs they didn't write. Outside activities. Can any of you do something outside the group? For example, can you have a solo career or a side project with another band? Or individually endorse a product, say a drum set if you're a drummer? And if so, do the earnings from that belong to the individual, or does the band share in it? Most of the time, unless someone joins the band who already has a solo career, side projects require the band to agree, and things get worked out case by case. If there's an agreement up front to allow outside projects, the agreement will say that the band has to be the first priority, meaning the soloist can't take on something that would interfere with the band's schedule of recording, touring, publicity, etc. That, of course, means first priority for your time. You can't schedule an outside activity while you're supposed to be on tour with the band. But it also means there can't be any other kind of interference. For example, you couldn't endorse Coke as a soloist if the band is sponsored by Pepsi. Other issues. Here are the other major issues in a partnership agreement. Firing. What kind of vote does it take to fire a member? Majority? Unanimous of everyone else? Unanimous of everyone doesn't work, since the guy being fired usually votes the other way. Hiring. What kind of vote is required to take in a new partner? Or to hire a lawyer, agent, or manager? Majority? Unanimous? When my son Danny was 12, we came back from vacation to discover that his band had hired a manager and keyboard player without even asking him. It ultimately broke up the band. Yours could be next. Quitting. Is everyone free to quit at will? Note, this only concerns leaving the other band members. You're not free to quit under your record deal, and if you're in the middle of a tour, you're not free to walk out on the concert promoters without getting the teeth sued out of your mouth. There's no way to force someone to continue working with a group, but you can penalize them if they don't. For example, you can stop him or her from working as a musical artist after quitting, require the member to pay his or her solo earnings to the partnership, meaning the other group members get a piece, and require him or her to pay for any damages caused by their leaving. On the other hand, I've always been in favor of letting people go if they're unhappy, as long as they don't walk out in the middle of a tour or otherwise leave some third party hanging. Why force someone to stick around and make both your lives miserable? Incurring expenses. What kind of vote do you need for the group to spend money? It's common to say that some extraordinary issues, like borrowing money or spending over a certain dollar amount, take a bigger percentage vote than day-to-day expenses. Contributions. What kind of vote do you need to make partners contribute to the partnership? Translation: put in money. For example, if the group needs dough to buy equipment, cover unexpected expenses, etc. Amendment of partnership agreement. What kind of vote does it take to change the terms of the partnership deal? For example, can a majority vote reduce your percentage, or does it take your consent? Death or disability. What happens in the event of your death or disability? Your partners don't usually want your surviving spouse or parents voting on partnership matters. Not likely they'll get on stage and sing. For this reason, there's normally a buyout, as we'll see in the section coming up, and you're treated as if you'd quit the partnership or were terminated. Ex-partners. If you quit or are terminated as a partner, do you keep your same percentage level for past activities? Almost always, yes. Do you get a percentage of future activities? Almost always, no. Do you get bought out of your share of assets of the group? And if so, at what price and over what period of time? Buyouts. Here's a buyout provision used by one of my clients for leaving partners. Price. The price of the buyout equals the leaving partner's percentage of all hard assets owned by the partnership. Hard assets means things you can touch, sound equipment, instruments, cash, etc., as opposed to intangibles, such as the group name, recording contracts, etc. For example, if the hard assets are worth $100,000 and the partner had a 25% interest, his or her share of the assets would be worth $25,000. This is usually done on a value as opposed to cost basis, because used equipment is generally worth less than the cost. It can also be done on something called book value, which is an accounting concept meaning the value on the books of the partnership. Book value is typically the original cost minus some scheduled factor of depreciation that's worked out by your accountant. Of these three methods, book value is likely to be the lowest, although it's possible the real value could be less. Cost is the least accurate measure of anything. I specifically provide that there is no value given to any intangible rights. First, I think they're very difficult to value, if not impossible, and it's expensive to hire an appraiser to give an opinion. Second, and directly tied in, is the fact that the value may be very different after someone leaves the group. For example, if the lead singer / songwriter goes, the group name and record deal may be worthless. Conversely, a new lead singer might join and make things a lot more successful than they were before. Also, I think the leaving member's contingent payout, discussed in the contingent payout section to come, compensates for the intangibles. In essence, that's a form of valuing them. You should know that not everyone agrees with this approach to intangibles. There are certain situations where a name is worth a lot of money after the group has broken up. For example, the Beatles, the Doors, and Led Zeppelin still generate tons of dough from the use of their names in merchandising, and it's not illogical to give an ex-member some reduced piece of materials created after the member has left. Note, if the band breaks up, everyone continues to own their shares of the name. Despite all that, and despite the fact that it could arguably create an unfair result, I still like my way. You can't know in advance what a particular member will really contribute to the value of the name, or how much value will be added or lost after that member leaves. And figuring it out after the fact makes lawyers rich. So in this client's deal, we say there is no value given to the intangibles. Cash payout. In the partnership deal for this band, the value of hard assets is paid out over a period of 2 years, at the rate of 25% each 6 months. Thus, in our $25,000 example, $6,250 would be paid 6 months after termination. $6,250 is paid 12 months after, and so forth. Because the total isn't paid up front, the leaving partner usually gets interest on the unpaid balance. The reason for structuring a payout over time is to protect the remaining members from having to come up with a big chunk of cash, which they may not have. Also, it's not uncommon to provide that the terminated partner can look only to the assets of the partnership for his or her buyout payments. That means the other individual partners aren't personally responsible if the partnership tanks and has no money to pay. Contingent payout. The leaving member or members get their continuing percentage from activities of the partnership in which they participated. This means royalties from records they played on, monies from merchandise using their names or likeness, concerts and TV shows in which they performed, etc. Remember, there are special record contract provisions about leaving members which may affect their continuing royalties. Refer back to the group provisions in record deals earlier in this chapter. In this deal, the leaving members don't get any portion of the group earnings from performances and other activities that happen after they leave. Legal ethics. You should be aware of a common ethical problem that groups have. As we discussed in Chapter 5, a lawyer who represents a group and draws up a partnership agreement has a built-in conflict of interest. A conflict of interest, called in shorthand a conflict, means the lawyer represents two clients whose interests are adverse to each other. So if a lawyer represents the partnership, he or she can't take sides and represent any one of you against any other of you. However, this is exactly what making a partnership agreement requires, because the various members' best interests aren't the same. For example, extra chunks of money going to Sylvia have to come from the others, whose best interests are to keep them. Same with voting percentages. A manager, business manager, or agent who counsels you about group matters also has the same conflict, though lawyers are subject to strict ethical codes that don't apply to others. This situation, of course, happens every day, so those of us in the industry are used to dealing with it, and all ethical lawyers will advise you of its existence. You can do one of two things. One, each member can get independent counsel, which may or may not be affordable, to negotiate the agreement among yourselves. This also takes a lot of time and can be destructive if anyone decides to be a hero. However, it's the best way to do it. Two, far more commonly, the lawyer explains all the issues to you openly and then lets you decide among yourselves how you want to resolve them. In this case, the lawyer doesn't represent any of you, but rather just acts as a secretary, writing down whatever agreement you reach on your own. If you use this route, your lawyer will ask you to sign a conflict waiver, which says he or she has explained the conflict to you, and you're going ahead anyway. Corporation versus partnership. Once you've decided all these issues, how do you set yourself up? The choices are a partnership, LLC, or corporation. And the major differences, as we discussed at the top of Chapter 14, are tax planning aspects, the liability limitations, and the fact that corporations are more expensive to set up and run. By liability limitations, I mean that corporations limit the assets that can be grabbed by someone suing you. In a corporation, if you handle things properly, they can only get the assets of the corporation. With a partnership, however, they can grab both the partnership's assets and the personal assets of every partner. That means you. While these are nice benefits of corporations, they're offset by the increased cost of setting up and running the suckers, so it's marginal in your early stages. Also, as we noted earlier, a corporation doesn't protect you from record company liability because of the inducement letter we discussed at the top of Chapter 14. Nor does it protect you from copyright infringement liability, as we also discussed at the top of Chapter 14. A limited liability company, or LLC, is basically a partnership, but it provides the limited liability of a corporation, though it has the same exceptions to liability we just discussed for corporations, meaning it doesn't shield you from claims by your record company or copyright infringement claims. Because an LLC is as cheap and easy to use as a partnership, it's the vehicle du jour for many groups. The mechanical difference between a partnership or LLC and a corporation is that If you want a partnership or LLC, you need one agreement. And if you want a corporation, you need two agreements. Specifically, for a partnership, you need a written partnership agreement, and for an LLC, you need a member agreement. The owners of the LLC are called members. For a corporation, you need 1. A shareholder agreement, meaning an agreement among the shareholders of a corporation, and 2. Employment agreements between yourselves and the corporation or the LLC. To sum up, if you don't have a written agreement, most states have laws that spell out what happens. Generally, everybody owns everything equally and has an equal vote, which may or may not be what you want. So I highly recommend that you do your own agreement. As we just discussed, there are complicated issues to solve, and you'll be way better off doing it yourself rather than leaving it to the ding-a-lings in your state capital. Answer to trivia quiz from earlier this chapter. Name the lead singers who have had solo careers after leaving the following groups. 1. The Police, Sting. 2. White Stripes, Jack White. 3. Destiny's Child, Beyoncé Knowles. Name the groups from which the following soloists came. 1. Justin Timberlake, NSYNC. 2. Neil Young, Buffalo Springfield. 3. Eminem, D12. Chapter 22. What's in a Name? Rights in a Name. A number of years back, a band named Green Jello changed its name to Green Jelly to avoid a dispute with the owners of the Jello trademark. While the group ultimately got some good publicity from all the flap, having a name that steps on somebody else's toes can be a serious problem. The most common problems don't come from naming your band after snack foods, but rather from another group that used the name before you did. And this is equally important if you're an individual, especially if you're not using your real name, or sometimes even if you are using your birth name. No, I'm not that Paul McCartney. So when it comes to your name, there are two legal things to deal with. 1. Before you start, you have to make sure nobody is already using your name. And 2. Once you're clear, you have to take some steps to keep other people from ripping it off. Check it out. You should figure out if someone else is using your name as soon as possible, ideally before you use it. If you use someone else's name just on Facebook, SoundCloud, Bandcamp, FanBridge, or some similar site, you might get a snippy letter, but you can usually work it out. We'll see a little later in this chapter how things get worked out. Things get way more serious when you release music or start touring over a wide geographic area. And changing a name once you've built up a following is not a happy event. If you're about to sign a record deal and someone can stop your label from putting out your music, it could cost the label a lot of money. And if it does, the record company will turn to you with a handful of gimme. Every record deal makes you guarantee that they can use your name without any legal hassles, which means you have to pay for the mess, if there is one. After being stung by a few of these situations, most record companies now check the names of new artists before they release music. Their goal is to determine A, if someone is currently using the name, and whether they started using it before you did, or B, whether someone used it a while ago and still has some recordings available, or is planning a reunion. Unfortunately, there's no way to ever be 100% sure. But here's what the record companies do, and you can also check these sources on your own. 1. The internet is a great way to do your preliminary searches. A. Try looking up your name on a search engine like Google or Bing to see what comes up. Also, try social networking sites like